Welcome to Mighty Parenting, the podcast with real, raw, and relevant talk about raising teens and parenting young adults. Here are your hosts, Judy Davis and Sandy Fowler.
Welcome to Mighty Parenting, a community where we help you raise teens and parent 20-somethings so they can become happy, successful, and emotionally healthy adults. I'm Sandy Fowler, and I'm hosting solo today as Judy continues to take care of her hubby and do what she needs to do with her family. And speaking of taking care of and caring, be sure that you pop over to mightyparenting.com where we have taken care to give you some of the resources that can help you with your parenting journey. There's the private Facebook group, our free email series on how to communicate with your teen, along with other resources to support you in your parenting journey. Today, we are talking about atypical kids. And it's interesting. Did you know that actually 1 in 5 children has a brain that is wired differently? And it could be lots of different things. It could be ADHD, dyslexia, Asperger's, giftedness, anxiety, sensory processing disorder, or some other neurodifference. But anyone with a child in this realm knows that there are challenges for the child and the parent. And even if your child isn't one with differences, chances are that they have a friend who is, and they certainly have kids in their classes, on their teams, in their organizations who are dealing with this. In my world, I have 2 people in my nuclear family who live with differences, my husband and my daughter. Now, whether it's the overwhelming sounds in a restaurant, the discomfort of certain clothing, an inability to be hugged and touched in a moment, the challenge of organizing, a struggle to read people's emotions and interpret social situations, they are heroic in their effort to live in a world that is absolutely not designed for them. For me, it means being aware and accepting and sometimes standing up for them. Because really, I found that even family and friends don't truly understand and they aren't able to put themselves in my daughter or my husband's shoes a lot of times. And when that happens, even those closest to us can misinterpret their behaviors and then we have fallout from that. I see that. I see the confusion, the frustration, and the pain that that causes on both sides. And I believe that all of us are dealing with that in some capacity or another, like I said, either in your family or in your social circle or in your community. And I believe that shedding light on this and having an honest, open conversation can help parents who are living in a neurodiverse household to cope. But I also believe that having a better understanding can help the rest of us as we interact with family living with neurodiversity. So, to that end, we have Debbie Reber with us today. Debbie is a mom who has a neurodiverse son, and she is leading the way for parents to raise neurodiverse kids with confidence, connection, and joy. She is a parenting activist, a New York Times bestselling author, a podcast host, and a speaker who moved her career in a more personal direction back in 2016 when she founded Tilt Parenting, which is a website, a weekly podcast, and a social media community for parents like her who are raising differently wired children. And today, she's joining us for this candid conversation about a differently wired world. So, Debbie, welcome to Mighty Parenting.
Thank you so much, Sandy.
Neurodiversity, I think, is actually a new word or a new concept for many parents. So, would you share with us how you define neurodiversity?
Sure. And you did such a nice job of explaining it in your introduction, but you know, you started by talking about 1 in 5 kids being in some way neurodiverse. I would just even start by saying, I believe the number is much higher than that. I believe that so many more kids and people are moving through the world in a way that is considered in some way not typical. So, you know, neurodiversity is a movement right now, which I did not start. It was primarily started by the autistic community, who is trying to move forward this idea that there is no one way that the brain functions, and that actually things like autism and other neuro differences like ADHD and things that would be considered not typical are actually just normal variations within the way that the brain is wired. And so this movement is really about, the neurodiversity movement is really about not looking at people whose brains are wired in an atypical way as being this other group or that they're not normal, but rather it's just part of this wide range of variations in terms of how our brains are wired. So that's just kind of a little background on neurodiversity as a movement. And when I talk about neurodifferences, I try to cast a very wide net. So those differences that you mentioned, like ADHD, sensory processing issues, learning disabilities, everything from dyslexia or dysgraphia to slow processing speed to executive functioning deficits. This could be anxiety, it could be OCD, could be just being highly gifted, which is a special need in its own right. And then of course there's a lot of crossover with these differences. So a lot of kids have multiple things going on, but the bottom line is that there is some aspect to the way their brain is wired that makes fitting into traditional educational models, fitting into what's quote unquote expected from kids, can bring on a lot of challenges for them and their families.
I absolutely agree with you, Debbie, that there are many more people. I mentioned that my husband is neurodiverse. People who listen to the show regularly know that he is on the autism spectrum, but he was only diagnosed in his 50s. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there are many, many people, as you said, moving through the world who are dealing with challenges. And we had made some assumptions prior to that, thinking that he was ADHD, but even that didn't really come into our life or onto our radar until, I can't remember, I think it was still in his 40s at the time. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it's that idea, like you said, that they're not actually different. And I know that 1 in 5 number is the one that's published, right? So we have these other people. And when you look it up, you go, okay, well, 10% of the people in the world are left-handed. 8 to 10% have blue eyes, but here we have 20% or more of our population, and we're calling them different and doing it in a way that is derogatory, that is saying that they aren't okay, that there's something wrong with them, that we need to fix them. It reminds me of the old school days where they would make left-handed kids write with their right hand. And we've moved past that. And I think of this neurodiversity movement as something that can help us move past the old ideas that we have about the way people should be in this world. Now, you have a son, Asher, who mm-hmm. is gifted and I believe has ADHD and Asperger's. Is that correct?
Yeah, actually, he recently was diagnosed and no longer met the criteria for Asperger's, but definitely ADHD. That's kind of the prevalent thing. And yeah, he's also profoundly gifted. So he's twice exceptional is what that's called when you have giftedness paired with some other neurodifference.
Well, see, in that change in diagnosis, I have spoken with a couple of doctors recently who I like the way that they put it. They essentially said that a diagnosis is just a way of labeling symptoms that you're experiencing at that moment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so many of these things can shift and change over time in that, well, one, our brains have neuroplasticity, so who knows how mm-hmm. things change there, but also our kids learn or we learn new skills, new coping strategies, new ways of being, hopefully our culture and our environment. The people around us learn new ways of being so that we can just be ourselves. Our kids can be themselves without necessarily having to worry about, you know, exactly what this label is. Mm-hmm. I was curious, though, before Asher was initially diagnosed, were you aware of this idea of neurodiversity at that time?
I don't think I had ever heard the word, no. You know, when he was really little, we knew that he was very bright, you know, and he was a really intense kid, little guy in preschool, and those years were really challenging because he was emotionally dysregulated a lot of the time because of sensory issues and otherwise. But we had no idea what we were dealing with or what to do. I'm certain the word neurodiversity was not even on my radar for many years to come. It was a very slow process of kind of discovering who he is and then also trying to navigate a path through a traditional educational model and coming up against all of the, you know, the barriers to having that be successful that dove me deeper into learning more about this community and what so many kids are facing.
Well, and I think that's part of where the normal comes from. You talked about discovering who he is. And I think for many parents that those initial nigglings are, oh, my child is different. So it kind of takes us back to that different versus normal concept. But the way we were talking about, we said, you know, looking at the sheer number of people, it means that really our neurodiverse community shouldn't really be considered outliers. And then that made me wonder, okay, so what is this normal that we always talk about? You know, it seems to me, especially when you get into a child's group environment, schools, teams, organizations, those types of things, that normal is more about a child who's compliant and well-behaved according to the view of the adult in charge at the moment.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, normal is a construct that is old and outdated, and it is based exactly on that. Kids who are able to comply and be cooperative and who kind of fall in line in a more authoritarian structure. And, you know, the kids who, you know, I think a lot of those kids who are the well-behaved, I'm using air quotes here, which you can't see, but the well-behaved children, those compliant children, it's maybe because they are really wanting to please people, or, you know, that's part of how they're wired, but it's not because they just are naturally compliant. It's because they're responding to authority figures in a different way. But I totally agree. I mean, I think normal doesn't really exist. And this is really a problem for kids, you know, because that's where our kids spend most of their time in school. And in most educational systems, they're just not designed to accommodate different ways of being. They're not designed to accommodate a kid who needs to move his body or who, you know, wants to share his or her knowledge in a way that is different from what the assignment is, you know? So it is always about fitting in. And so the quote unquote normal kids are the ones who are better at kind of gaming that system and who are better at kind of moving through that. But it doesn't necessarily mean that those kids are even thriving. They're just able to get through that system until they can reach a point in university or beyond where they can really then lean into who they are as humans.
I'm thinking about that because I have two girls and one is neurodiverse and one is not. And my one who's not is very good at dealing with that environment, managing that environment. But exactly what you said, you know, as she got into college, it was like she really got to spread her wings and see more about who she is. And like the first time she skipped a class, and not that I want my child skipping all her college classes, but just to know that she was thinking about her and herself and what was best for her and her life in that moment, I was so excited that she skipped a class. And I think we're losing so much for all of our kids, you know, by waiting that long. But I think it really hurts our neurodiverse kids the most. So you made the comment that our kids spend most of their time in these environments, these schools and groups and things. What happens to our neurodiverse kids when they have to spend a lot of time there? What's kind of the fallout that you see?
Oh, it can just do so much emotional harm. You know, for a child who is getting corrected a lot, not just by their teacher, but often their peers, you know, who are better at reading social cues and knowing that, you know, this is a time when we're all supposed to move in this direction and there's this kid going in the opposite direction, they must be bad. And so there can be, you know, just the classroom culture can be one that ultimately can feel very shaming and negative for differently wired kids. And this is something that so many of them internalize. They start to identify as the bad kid. They lose their love of learning. They can become more anxious and depressed. These kids are at such higher risk of depression as they move through the school system. And they ultimately, you know, some of them can recover once they get out of the confines of that system and be more accepted and be able to be who they are, but many of them don't. And so there's that bigger cost to society. If you think about the unique gifts that differently wired people have in terms of creative problem solving and just being a nonconformist can be so useful in society because these are the people who can think about the big problems in unique and fresh ways. And so we potentially are losing out on all of those gifts as well. So there's that personal cost to the student, which can stick with kids their entire lives. You know, you mentioned your husband was identified in his 40s and 50s with some neural differences. I'm doing an episode right now where I'm interviewing four different adults who were diagnosed in their 40s, two with ADHD and two on the spectrum. And the pain that they are having to kind of just reconcile with the child that was never understood, the way that they spent their whole life masking just so they could fit in while really beating themselves up or just having a real low self-esteem. I mean, that is something that many of these kids won't be able to get rid of.
And if they do, it's a long, hard process for many of them.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. It's not you go, oh, I'm neurodiverse, and so everything is okay, because that's just not physiologically how our bodies work. All of those years end up kind of becoming part of us and part of what happens. As I was listening to you talk and also thinking about this idea of, you know, all these adults who didn't know and they get diagnosed or self-diagnosed later on, at least recognize that, oh, this might just be because of the way I am. It made me think about parents who are listening who don't necessarily know they have a neurodiverse child. So I kind of want to take a second and go, let's talk about some of these things that you might see in your child. We discussed the idea that when they spend a lot of time in school and they're getting corrected, you said, you know, there's emotional harm that can happen. You said they can identify as the bad kid and lose their love of learning. And in my mind, I'm translating that to, oh, so I have this teenager who's sulky and impossible to get to go to school and they can't stand it. Maybe, and I'm not saying that this is always the case, but at Mighty Parenting, we believe in living curious and asking questions and getting to the reasons for things that are going on with our kids instead of just laying down the law and saying, this is how you must behave, this is what's acceptable, this is what's not, and that's the end of it. Because for something like this, if our child is neurodiverse, it may be that these things have been happening in school, or they maybe had the skills to cope with that environment for a number of years, but as things get more difficult, I know with my daughter, the executive function at every level was, of course, more difficult. And yes, she made it through college and academically did well, but it got harder for her as she went. Mm-hmm. And now making this leap out into the working world with all these, I won't say new skills, because she's had to deal with them to some degree, but not to the intensity that she had to before in the executive function. You know, it gets harder at each level. So are there other things? I'm thinking, like I said, one was, you know, sulky teenager not wanting to go to school. What might be some of the other behaviors or signs we could be seeing in our child that might indicate that, hey, maybe this is what their real challenge is that they have some kind of diversity. It could be, you know, that they're just bored. Like you said, if they're gifted and they're sitting in this regular classroom without being challenged, they might just be bored out of their mind. There could be lots of things.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a big believer that everything that our child does, all their behavior, it's all a form of communication, and there's always a reason. And so I love that you talked about being really curious, because I think that is critical. So, you know, when we start to notice in any way that our child isn't thriving, and it could be like starting to opt out of things, you know, and becoming more withdrawn, or maybe you notice that your kid is starting to immerse his or herself into video games more, and they're acting really unmotivated, and you might just think, gosh, they're really just lazy, unmotivated teenager, but it might actually be something else going on, that they're needing kind of an escapism because they are not doing well on another emotional level because of a neurodifference. They might not be reaching milestones at expected times, right? So for kids with learning differences, especially things like slow processing speed, which is just something a lot of people aren't even aware is a thing. And so when a child is really having a lot of resistance, for example, around writing, even though you know they have really good ideas and they can express themselves verbally, but they can't write a paper to save their lives, that can be a sign that there's an executive functioning and slow processing speed happening. The kids who are really disorganized and you have to remind them 20 times and they're still not getting it, that can be really frustrating to teachers and parents, you know, and they might just think the child is lazy. Again, that could be executive functioning, that could be ADHD. So I think it's important, you know, just as parents, that we pay attention to those things that we find ourselves getting frustrated over, things that we're getting feedback from teachers or coaches about our kids on, you know, that seem to be quote unquote problems. And then also our child's behavior and whether or not they seem like they're thriving. And if they're not, getting curious about what could be underlying these things, because we know that a child wouldn't choose to get in trouble, right? That's not maybe 0.0003% of kids, you know, are naturally mischievous and like that, but that's not really how we're wired. We want to succeed. Like we want to fit in. That's a human thing. And so when we're getting feedback that there are issues in any of those areas, then that is a cue for us to stop and say, okay, I wonder what might be happening here. What could be behind this behavior? What could be behind, you know, these notes that I'm getting from the coach? What's really going on here? And then start to dig a little deeper.
And if they are getting in trouble, especially, I'm thinking again more toward the tween and teen years, that also could be a sign. You mentioned this idea early, saying, right, sometimes our child will start to identify as the bad kid because essentially they've been told that from the time they were little. So unless, again, like you said, yeah, there's a very small percentage of the population that they come out causing trouble and they seem to really enjoy it from day one. But if your child was not naturally like that, and I don't mean, and that's, I think that's a little bit of a little potential trap for parents too, is we have to redefine what causing trouble is. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about a little kid and a very small child, like in my husband's family, you know, he and one of his brothers, very physically active, and they'll be, you know, climbing up on top of the refrigerator. That's not actually causing trouble. Mm-hmm. That's not a child who is capable of understanding rules and the rationality of keeping them or breaking them. That's just a child following their natural instincts. Mm-hmm. So if we see that our child is truly intentionally becoming the bad boy, the bad girl, heading down that road, again, that could be something that could be another sign. Are there things that we as parents unwittingly do that contribute to the problems that our neurodiverse kids are facing, either in school in their organizations or at home?
Oh my goodness, yes, every single day. And even being aware of them as a parent, I still do it. Like, you know, this is very complicated because, you know, as parents, we come into this role with expectations and our own baggage of what our childhood was like, of who we want to be as parents. We have this vision of who our kids are going to be. So there's a lot wrapped up in that. And so as you were even just talking about behavior, you know, we might think something's bad behavior because we were raised getting in trouble for that very same thing. But we've never questioned, wait a minute, is this actually bad behavior? This is a child being a child. You know, so I think we have all these kind of assumptions that we bring into our parenting relationship that if we don't examine those, we can butt up against our kids all the time because we might parent them using a philosophy that they will completely push back against, and it will result in never-ending conflict. You know, the more we want to control our child's behavior, especially as they become tweens and teens, you know, that can be a recipe for disaster with a lot of differently wired kids who have more inflexible thinking, or they really struggle with people placing demands on them. So, you know, we might be pouring gasoline on the fire just by the parenting choices we're making or the philosophy that we're subscribing to. We might push our kids to do certain activities or feel that it's not okay to quit a sport because, you know, you need this to build grit and resilience. Meanwhile, our child might be in fight or flight mode, you know, perpetually because of feeling dysregulated in that sport. And so it's important that we then step back and recognize what's happening with the child and not push ahead with our own agenda. So I think we can get really just keep moving down this path. And if we don't take the time to step back and look at who our child is as their own unique being, and again, get curious about what's happening with them and what would best support them, then we can be triggering them without even being aware of it by thinking we're doing the right thing, you know? So it takes a lot of conscious intention and effort and every day to try to not let our agenda interfere with who our kids naturally are.
And this is actually, while there are nuances and there are some differences here, it is a real fit with everything that we've been thinking about and learning about and teaching about here in this community with all of our kids. It is this idea of looking at why they're doing things and understanding what's best for them. And the older they get, you know, respecting them as people who can make decisions in their own life. But there is definitely, when you have a neurodiverse child, there are definitely nuances to that situation. I think there's also a pitfall, because I just ran into this one myself with my daughter. This would be a few months ago. She's in an in-between stage. And so she's living at our house usually 2 or 3 days out of a week. And so I'm still encouraging her, working with her, helping her learn new skills, and had gone through and said, okay, you know, we've agreed on, this is the thing she needs to work on. This is the piece that she wants mom to help with, you know, this is where it makes sense for me to be supporting her. And we picked a time in a day that she needed to go to the local bank and actually credit union and take care of some financial stuff. And I was just going as a backup support mechanism. She was handling it. However, that also happened, that day that she chose to do it also happened to be a day where she had a lot of other things to do. And when we met, she was frustrated and she was a little leaning toward overwhelmed, not completely overwhelmed. And it would have been very easy. The trap that is very easy for us to fall into, I think, of parents who have differences is, oh, that's okay, honey. We don't have to do that today. You're trying to deal with so many other things. I know executive function is hard for you. But I had to also look at it and go, well, is this something she is truly not capable of doing? She does not actually have the capacity to do it. Or is this something that she needs to learn the hard lesson of, you picked a bad time to do it, but it's got to be done, so you do it anyway. And we did, you know, I didn't lay down the law. I just didn't say anything. I let her complain. I let her rant. I let her, because as she did it, she started spouting out things like, oh, I shouldn't have picked the day when I had other things to do and stuff like that. And I thought it through and went, you know, I know she has enough time to manage it. This is just how it feels to her. I'm like, she has more than enough time to do everything she needs to do. But there is that pitfall, that overprotecting. I know Judy Davis, our co-host, her son has some differences, and she freely talks about on the show and in presentations about how she overcompensated for him. And when they were doing some of their family therapy things, he's a recovering drug and alcohol addict. And in there, he looks at her, he's like, I so played you. I had you typing my papers for me and doing all these things. He's like, I knew you would do whatever I wanted you to do. Mm. So there's that side of it as well. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you struggle with that ever yourself, Debbie.
No, never. No. no, I really appreciate what you shared. And, you know, it is a fine line. And I think it is something we have to be really aware of, because for a lot of us, when our kids are younger, you know, we actually can be their frontal lobe for them. Right. And so, and that's a role as a parent that we might just forget that we long-term is not a good situation. So, it is about as our kids get older, finding ways to give them scaffolding and also giving them a lot of room to try things and fail and in a safe way. But I love how you just listen, just let your child rant without judging or trying to fix, and that she kind of learned through that, which is what we really want. And so that's something that my child's 14 now. So I'm very much in this place of trying to give him a lot more control. In fact, I've really handed the reins over to him, unless it's a safety issue where he could get injured or something. Like, I'm really trying to say, well, what do you think? What, you know, this is your choice. And whether that's about academics, I'm just taking a huge step back and letting him become more self-directed. I'm a big fan of the book by Ned Johnson and Dr. William Stixrud, The Self-Driven Child, and it's really changed how I view my parenting role. And it's really interesting to see, and to see how capable our kids are, and also know that that they need to screw up. They need to feel frustrated. They need to experience all those things in order to figure out how they can best navigate those issues, you know, as they get older and become adults.
And oftentimes it comes back to fear, our fear. As you said, yeah, you know, we have these expectations, we have all these ideas, all this baggage we're carrying. But in your book, in Differently Wired, you talk about parenting from a place of possibility instead of fear. Mm-hmm. I'd like it if you could share a little bit about that with us, because that, even just saying that sentence, oh, I can parent from possibility and let go of my fears, it just feels so nice.
Yeah. And I think most of us don't consider that we can do that. We are so driven by fear. I mean, I think as a culture, we are, we're afraid of, there's fear of missing out, there's fear of not making enough money, there's fear of, you know, so it's a kind of a pervasive aspect to most people's lives. And then with our kids, there's so much to be afraid of, especially when we consider their future and what that might look like. And so when we make decisions from that place, when we choose, you know, the school that they're going to from a fear place, like, well, if I don't do this, then that will mean X, Y, and Z won't happen. Or, you know, when we use that as the driving force, we're not we're actually limiting what's possible for our child. We're not trusting in their ability to thrive. We're trying to control the situation. Whereas if we can pivot and say, you know, the truth is we have no idea what this child's journey is meant to be. They are on their own unique path. Our role is not to create it for them. It's to support them so they can move through it from a place of strength and knowing who they are. And so if we look at it from that perspective and recognize that there are no guarantees in life for any of us. And what if this would happen? And who knows what would happen in this situation? Or maybe this is exactly what this child is supposed to go through in order to have the transformation that's going to lead them to their best self. So it's about letting go of control and realizing that we actually don't have any in any aspect of our lives, and instead getting curious about what could be. And even just that little shift, it will change the energy that we bring to our parenting, and it will certainly let us think more openly about everything from, again, what school or summer camp our child goes to just how we, you know, move through the parent-child dynamic in our day-to-day life.
And when they are kids, many of those types of decisions, after you get into it, if you find that it's truly wrong for your child, you can change it.
Always.
Those things are not permanent. I was thinking about it earlier when you talked about, you know, sometimes we do have to let our kids quit something. We had encouraged our daughter to join the high school cross country team as a way of meeting new people. We were in a new city. We were going from homeschooling into the public school system. We're like, this starts early. You can meet people. Nobody stopped and thought about the fact that she was not an athlete. And so she wasn't meeting people because she was way back. And then add to that the neuro differences and everything else. You know, we encouraged her and had her keep with it. She didn't go day one and then quit. I talked with her. Her dad talked with her. We listened to her. And as we looked at her and listened to her, we went, this is emotionally damaging to her. Mm-hmm. However, later on, she decided to try out Taekwondo. And she went to the first class and she felt overwhelmed and she was stressed out and she didn't want to go back. And so we went through this cycle similarly, but that one, it was not damaging her. And so we just kept encouraging her to keep doing this, and it turned out amazing. She's still, you know, that is still a passion for her and something that she loves. But in this place of fear, one of the other things I think that happens is that we isolate ourselves, we isolate our kids because as parents, we're afraid to talk to people or we're afraid to speak out because of the stigma that can be placed on our child. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that?
That's so interesting. I was just talking with I'm staying with my parents right now for a few days, and we were discussing stigma and why people are still not open with their kids sometimes about their diagnoses they may have. You know, I think that there is a lot of fear, you know, also in how others are going to perceive us and judge us as parents. So that's one piece of this that's really complicated, because we're concerned what others are going to think of us. And then, yeah, we're afraid of our child being labeled in a certain way that's going to negatively impact them, or they'll be treated differently in school. And so we can just get very quiet and secretive. Many parents I hear from don't share with the child what's going on because they're afraid of that child feeling different, you know, more different than they already do perhaps. And so, but I believe that when we kind of sink into that secrecy and we don't openly share what's normal in our lives and what's actually normal for, you know, millions of people in the world, but we're all like living these secret lives, that we perpetuate the stigma, we make it harder for the kids to come, and we kind of continue staying stuck in this cycle of otherizing all these kids. So, I mean, I really think, you know, just personally, that and which, I mean, obviously I have a podcast, I talk about this stuff all the time. Like, I think we need to start talking about who our kids are without shame, without fear. This is exactly who they are and how their brain is wired, and there's nothing wrong with it. And it's time to shift that and just talk about it openly. But that fear is a pretty powerful emotion, and it can keep people feeling isolated and therefore more overwhelmed, and their families hurting longer than if they were to start opening up about what's happening.
Well, that brings to mind, again, parents who do not have a differently wired child. You know, this is a place where we can step in and help the situation. So if we run across a conversation or there's a situation going on where someone is obviously dealing with a child who's struggling in some way, you don't know if they're differently wired or not because they're not your child. Now, maybe it's one of your kids' friends and you see them around and you're like, yeah, I kind of think, or they are open about it. ADHD has come a long way. I find people and kids especially are like, oh yeah, I'm ADHD. Like, that has somehow become, it's made more headway in destigmatizing, I guess, is my personal experience. But I think that parents can be supportive of the parent who's in a struggling situation. Or again, if you just get curious, I know as the parent of a daughter who is neurodiverse that if someone asked me without judgment, without tone, hey, you know, I noticed her doing this and I was just kind of wondering if that's something that she is very interested, if that's something that helps her, or, you know, if she's walking through Meyer staring at her phone instead of making rude comments about teens and technology, go to that place of asking a question. Like I said, it's got to be without the judgment and the tone and everything, but wow, you know, I noticed that your daughter usually has her phone out when she's in Meyer. Is there something she's really into? Or something more along that line, but dropping the comments and the judgments, and I'm a little bit tweaked about that because I've been sharing something that actually was going on with my non-neurodiverse daughter, where we were allowing her to take control of a situation and take the reins, and people didn't like the way she was doing it. They didn't like the decision she was making. They didn't like how fast she was dealing with it. And because it involved a health issue on top of that, there were a lot of comments and pushback and judgment, I know, at me, and I imagine on her part too. So do you have other thoughts on how we as a community can support each other, whether we have neurodiverse kids or not?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really tricky conversation, and it's something I think a lot about because, you know, I was really, when I wrote my book Differently Wired, I really was hoping that it would be also shared among friends and family who may not have a neurodiverse human in their immediate, you know, family and have that experience. And while that is happening, there are people who get really defensive, who it triggers something for them that they feel as if those of us with differently wired kids, you know, are upset with them for not accommodating our kids more. And so it can be really messy. But what I would say is that I always invite parents to just a couple things. One is to just consider the way that you're talking about differences in your own family. So, you know, if there is a child who is the quote unquote troublemaker in your kid's class, you know, and your child's talking about them, even the things that we say in those conversations can shape how our kids are going to view that other student. And so just start talking about, oh, actually, I wonder if that's because, you know, that's this, you know, he must have ADHD. I've been reading about that, and this is actually what's going on. It's actually kind of interesting. And, you know, talking about it in different ways so we can, as a parent, help our kids who are neurotypical have a better understanding of difference, from a more informed place and not like a good versus bad. That's one thing. I think it's also pushing for inclusion in school programs and schools and after school activities and sports. You know, think about the PTAs and the other parent groups that you're in, and just be aware that a lot of the students in your school environment are neurodivergent, and just have that be on your radar to make sure that when you're creating programs or there are offerings, that those kids are being supported in a way that might not have been thought about before. And then, you know, you talking about the judgment, that's another big one. And, you know, I think the listeners of your show probably have older kids, but when our kids are younger, you know, a lot of us don't, our kids aren't included as much, or they may not be invited to play dates, even though people often are happy to have their child come to our house. So we don't get a lot of return invitations. And so just checking yourself on those things. And if there is a neurodivergent kid in your child's life, like get curious about that. And actually, how could we support this child at my house so that they could feel safe and secure and have a positive experience too? So it requires more work, but it's totally worth it. You know, it's worth it for our kids, for neurotypical kids, to have these friendships. They can bring so much to each other's lives. And so, and then, you know, parents of neurotypical kids have so much power in the current structure of schools and other paradigms. So that's a big responsibility, and we would love your help as allies.
It brings back to mind an episode of Atypical where there was going to be a school dance, and it was actually the main character's girlfriend who approached, I believe it was the PTA, about doing one of the dances where everybody has headphones to hear the music. Mm-hmm. So then her boyfriend, who is on the spectrum, could just not wear headphones and not have to be overwhelmed with the sound sensitivity that mm-hmm. he deals with. And I just think it's a really nice example of a way that it's not hurting anybody else, and it's allowing more kids to participate in a function.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great.
And so you also, you know, we talked about fear, and we talked about a lot of different things. We even touched a little, started edging toward this idea of moving out. And I know that when you're the parent of a neurodiverse child, things can feel very difficult, and we worry about our child's future. But Debbie, I think you bring a lot of hope when you say that the world will be differently wired, and that companies are currently touting diversity in terms of gender and culture, but need to appreciate neurodiversity as well. Can you talk just a little bit about that? Because when I saw that in your TED Talk, that to me was just a big beacon of hope.
Mm. Yeah, it is exciting. I mean, you know, I recorded that in November, and even since then, I've read many articles about more and more companies that are actively seeking neurodivergent employees, and because they're starting to recognize the unique gifts. So, you know, there's one company, it's called, oh goodness, I'm forgetting the name, something testing. It'll come to me. But they, I think 75% of their employees are on the autism spectrum because they are doing like a user experience, you know, software testing. And they find that those employees they bring in are uniquely qualified, you know, to test their systems because of the attention to detail and the ability to hyperfocus. You know, there are kids with dysgraphia who and dyslexia who, you know, part of that learning difference is an ability to flip images in your brain and see things from different dimensions and perspectives. And so if you think about engineering and graphic design, you know, that can be a real skill. And again, companies are starting to recognize that. And so there is this movement. I'm seeing it happen. I'm seeing more and more companies, you know, Microsoft is being a leader in this. They are recruiting differently wired students actively to join their team. And I think a lot in the Silicon Valley as well. But I do feel that the shift is coming. It makes me really excited for what's possible. And I think, again, as we have this generation of adults who are self-identifying or just now becoming diagnosed, that's also going to pave the way as people recognize, like, oh, I've actually been working with neurodivergent people this whole time, and now I understand why they are the way they are and why they're so good at this, you know, at this part of their job. And so it's just going to be this gradual education that's going to happen across the board, that, you know, our kids are going to grow up knowing who they are, knowing their strengths. Companies, you know, are going to hopefully continue making strides and recognizing, you know, that this group of people can bring unique, you know, gifts to their workplace. And I see it moving in a really exciting direction.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that piece. So just a quick kind of overview. We talked about how neurodiversity is actually a movement. And the idea of people being different doesn't really make a lot of sense. That normal is really an old, outdated construct where it's really more about kids who are being compliant in a situation. But when our kids are consistently dealing with being told that they're wrong, they're bad, and that they're different, and that they're not doing things right, it can create emotional harm. And so we need to work with our kids and make sure they understand who they are and their strengths, but we also need to work with the larger community, our schools, our organizations, other parents. And remember, at home and out and about, that every behavior that a child has, there's a reason for it. And then we as parents, we can be driven by fear. We need to work on letting that go. And I shouldn't say work on. We want to just free ourselves from that, because when we make decisions from that place of fear, we limit what's possible for our child and we limit their ability to thrive. Also, I love that you said this, when we get stuck in secrecy, when we get sucked into secrecy, we perpetuate the stigma. So we want to be talking and reaching out and doing this education of everybody just does things a little bit differently. And remember that there is change happening in the world, and that there are wonderful things happening, and our children have bright futures and they can have wonderful lives. We just want to make sure that neurodiverse or not, that we are honoring who our children are and what's best for them. So Debbie, we are listening to a podcast. So people listening love podcasts. So let's start with the name of your podcast.
My podcast is called Tilt Parenting,
which is also your website. So if you'd share that as well.
Yeah, so it's tiltparenting.com. And that is, I've just released episode 161 this morning. So I have a lot of conversations there. And that's also where you can learn more about these Tilt Together in-person groups that are starting to form around the US and Canada and the UK, and read a little bit about my book and just connect with a lot more resources.
Great, great. And thank you, Mighty Parents, for being here. I also want to thank you. I've been getting emails and comments and notes, messages from people, and I appreciate that. We're getting back to you, I think, pretty quickly still, but if you want to start sending in questions for the next Q&A show, go ahead and do that. We'll start gathering those together and pulling together the information for Q&A segment. And I just want to remind you that if you're here, you're listening, you are a mighty parent. Just remember that you've got this, and I will see you next week.